KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump is doubling down on his attacks against Harvard and other schools. We hear how faculty are reacting to efforts to cut funds and revoke the university's tax-exempt status. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Mark Zuckerberg is back in court as regulators argue that Meta's purchase of Instagram and WhatsApp hurt competition. I'm Michelle Martin.
And Amy Martinez, NPR's Bobby Allen, brings us details from inside the courtroom. Also, how should facilities filled with electric batteries be regulated? And record companies' tricks to get old albums new spots on the Billboard charts. It's Wednesday, April 16th. On this day in 1943, a chemist accidentally touched a substance he was working with, discovering that LSD causes hallucinations. What a trip. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Justice Department is suing the state of Maine. That's over Maine's refusal to ban transgender athletes from participating in women's and girls' sports. President Trump has signed an executive order barring trans athletes from doing this. Maine Democratic Governor Janet Mills has refused to comply. She says she has a duty to follow state law. This morning, U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi explained why her agency is suing Maine.
This is a violation of Title IX. The Department of Justice will not sit by when women are discriminated against in sports. This is about sports. This is also about these young women's personal safety.
The Trump administration has tried to force Maine to obey. It has moved to cut off all of Maine's funding for public schools over the issue of trans athletes, and it has also tried to cut off funding for school lunch programs. A U.S. Democratic senator from Maryland is now flying to El Salvador to try to secure the release of Kilmar Abrego Garcia. The Trump administration mistakenly deported the migrant from Maryland last month. NPR's Kristen Wright reports on the standoff between the Trump administration and Abrego Garcia's supporters.
Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen wants to visit Abrego Garcia, who's being detained in a Salvadoran mega prison. Van Hollen posted a video on X before he got on the plane.
I hope to have the chance to actually see Kilmar and see what his condition is. But we are going to keep fighting because this is a miscarriage of justice.
Van Hollen requested to meet with Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele, who said he's not returning Abrego Garcia. The U.S. government must explain under oath to a federal judge in the coming days what it's doing to bring him back. The Supreme Court ordered the administration to facilitate Abrego Garcia's return. Kristen Wright, NPR News, Washington.
The measles outbreak in Texas continues to grow, with 20 more cases reported over the past 5 days. As NPR's Ping Huang reports, the costs of containing the measles outbreak are also mounting.
The outbreak started in late January and has now grown to more than 600 cases across Texas, New Mexico, and Oklahoma. Dr. David Sugarman is a senior scientist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, working on its measles response.
You know, the estimates are that each measles case can be $30,000 to $50,000 for public health response work, and that adds up. Quite quickly.
A measles outbreak in New York City back in 2018 had around 650 confirmed cases and cost more than $8 million to bring under control. Sugarman says Texas has been asking for resources and help. The state lost several $100 million in public health funding in a federal clawback of COVID funds that began late last month. Ping Huang, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. President Trump has ordered a national security review of imports of critical minerals. These are widely used in defense and technology. Trump will decide whether to put tariffs on them. China leads the world's production of rare earth minerals, and Beijing has slapped export restrictions on these. Jury selection is underway in the retrial of Harvey Weinstein in New York. The disgraced former film producer is again facing charges. He sexually assaulted 3 women. Ilya Meretz reports.
Dozens of prospective jurors raised their hands when asked by the judge if they doubted they could be fair and impartial in this case. They were dismissed. Outside court, Lindsay Goldbrum, a lawyer for a Weinstein accuser whose identity has not yet been made public, said her client wants the jury to get to the truth.
During the trial, there will be a lot of pundits, commentators, and so-called experts discussing whether or not these acts were consensual. But what matters here is the fact.
Harvey Weinstein has pleaded not guilty. He was separately convicted of sex crimes in California in 2022. He's filed an appeal in that case. For NPR News, I'm Ilya Meretz in New York.
Former Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage has died of a pulmonary embolism, according to his consulting company. He was 79 years old. Armitage served under three Republican presidents, was the top deputy to former Secretary of State Colin Powell, and advocated a strong U.S. presence abroad. Armitage also disclosed he was the source who named the identity of CIA operative Valerie Plame after the invasion of Iraq. No criminal charges were lodged. Funeral details have not yet been announced. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. The battle between the Trump administration and Harvard University has moved to another front.
Yeah, the president threatened yesterday to revoke the school's tax-exempt status a day after cutting over $2 billion in federal funding and grants. Harvard's president had refused to implement the government's demands, which include overseeing academic departments and limiting student and faculty power.
NPR's Alyssa Nadworny is with us now to tell us more. Good morning, Alyssa.
Good morning.
So, you know, this isn't the first university the Trump administration has attacked, but I understand that the president took to social media to complain about Harvard specifically.
Yeah, the latest move in this standoff, which has about $9 billion in federal grants for Harvard hanging in the balance, it happened on Trump's Truth Social platform, with the president writing, quote, "Perhaps Harvard should lose its tax-exempt status and be taxed as a political entity if it keeps pushing political, ideological, and terrorist-inspired slash supporting sickness." And the background is, of course, on Friday, the administration sent Harvard a list of demands. Then on Monday, Harvard's president responded rejecting them, saying they were illegal and an attempt to dictate, quote, "what private universities can teach, whom they can admit and hire, and what areas of study and inquiry they can pursue."
I understand that there are already legal challenges to this.
Yes, a lawsuit filed late last week by Harvard's faculty, along with the American Association of University Professors, is challenging this administration demands tied with withholding funding.
Could you just say more about President Trump's threats to remove Harvard's tax-exempt status? What are the administrators saying about this?
Well, in my conversations with college leaders, many have said they were deeply worried about the administration moving beyond cutting research grants. And Trump's comments confirm those fears. Here's Ted Mitchell, president of the American Council on Education, which represents hundreds of colleges.
The catalog of horrors is a thick one, and there are plenty of things that the administration can seek to do that would throw institutions off kilter, and tax-exempt status is certainly one of them.
Nearly all colleges and universities are tax-exempt organizations. They're given nonprofit status, along with charities, religious institutions, and some political organizations. And that's allowed some elite institutions to amass huge endowments. Harvard is the largest at more than $50 billion.
So I was wondering, though, if President Trump actually has the authority to take away that status.
Well, Republicans have long sought to curb those tax exemptions, and while Trump doesn't necessarily have the total authority to revoke a college's tax status, he can use the Internal Revenue Service to do it in rare circumstances. There's also a bill in Congress that would give the president and the Treasury Secretary greater control over this.
Is there a precedent for what the administration's trying to do here?
So one example is Bob Jones University, which had an interracial dating and marriage ban, and the IRS ruled that those discriminatory policies were not charitable. That went all the way to the Supreme Court in the early 1980s. The college eventually dropped the ban and regained their tax status about two decades later.
And say more about why the Trump administration is doing this.
The White House has continued to maintain that they are rooting out anti-Semitism on campus. But going after colleges, which the administration deems left-leaning or too liberal, has long been a goal of Trump. Here is Trump speaking at an event in Florida in 2023.
After 50 years of leftist domination of the universities, I will take bold action to reclaim our colleges from the communist left.
And Michelle, in the last month, the administration has canceled about $11 billion in federal grants at a handful of elite colleges. And President Trump doesn't appear to be backing down anytime soon.
That is NPR's Alyssa Nadworny. Alyssa, thank you.
Thank you.
So what does this clash between Harvard and the Trump administration look like to people who study, teach, and conduct research at the school? Nicholas Bowie has both a law degree and a doctorate in history from Harvard and is now a law professor there, and he is with us now. Professor Bowie, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It would seem clear that the administration, as well as his allies in Congress and elsewhere, had Harvard in its sights. And I'm thinking about that congressional, that very contentious congressional hearing that led to the president being forced out last January. But I was wondering if you and other faculty were surprised in any way by the scale, you know, of the administration's attack, more than $2 billion in funding being frozen, demanding to oversee academic departments, this threat to revoke the tax-exempt status.
Yeah, I am. You know, my mother had Alzheimer's disease, and every month I drove her to Brigham and Women's Hospital, which is a Harvard affiliate, so she could participate in a study about slowing the progression of her disease. And I would be furious to learn that the study was canceled midway because the president stripped the hospital of its federal funding. Yet that's what the president right now is proposing. $7 out of $9 billion that Harvard receives from the government goes towards hospitals and medical research. And so for him to hold that research hostage is frankly appalling.
So I noticed that the university on its website is highlighting its research projects as one of the threatened projects about Alzheimer's disease and ALS and things of that sort.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So right now, the sciences and medical research at Harvard is directly impacted by federal funding, but pretty much everything that Harvard does is in some way related to the federal government. When I was a law student, I learned law from the International Human Rights Clinic at Harvard, and it took on powerful opponents like Shell or foreign countries to hold them accountable and ensure that they were adhering to international law. The demand letter last Friday took aim at that particular clinic. I can't imagine why, but I suspect that one reason is because the Trump administration doesn't like the legal positions it's articulating. And so I think it represents a threat to all of us at the university that no matter what we're researching or studying, if it happens to not meet, you know, the desires of the Trump administration, we could find ourselves in the crosshairs.
So one of the criticisms the Trump administration has leveled at Harvard is that there has not been adequate viewpoint diversity, meaning that there are not enough or fewer conservative viewpoints represented on the faculty and in the teaching and so forth. In Harvard's response on Monday, it said it had already made major changes over the last 15 months to devote resources to programs that promote ideological diversity. So isn't that in some way an admission that the Trump administration had a point there?
I think that it's important that faculty and administrators determine what is taught at Harvard and other universities. For us to change what we think is important because of prevailing orthodoxy in the White House would turn Harvard's pursuit of truth, its motto of Veritas, into just pursuit of popular opinion. That may be an important role for politicians to take and elected officials, but it's not the role of academics. Our job is to, you know, gain wisdom and understanding. And of course, that requires bringing in diverse viewpoints. And of course, having conservative and other colleagues who can participate in these conversations is critical. But it shouldn't be done at the point of a financial gun.
So you have expertise in constitutional law, and I want to note that there have been, and my colleague Alyssa Nedworthy noted, that there are two lawsuits that have been filed against the administration, trying to oppose these moves at Harvard. One, it pertains to immigration enforcement policies targeting non-citizens for expressing pro-Palestine views, which the lawsuit says is a violation of the First Amendment. The other one speaks to these funding freezes. As briefly as you can, does the administration or do the people who file these lawsuits feel confident that you may be successful in opposing these changes?
We do. You know, no law in this country permits the president to seize federal funds and to just keep them until an institution complies with his personal will. You know, there's laws that govern how federal funds are used because they're used for important things like research. The Constitution also just prohibits public officials from abusing their power to punish their political enemies. That's what the president is doing here when he's deporting students for protesting injustices in Gaza. That's what he's, and it doesn't permit him to punish the rest of the university either for how it disciplined those students.
That's Nicholas Bowie. He's Louis D. Brandeis Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. Professor Bowie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The Trump administration plans to ask Congress to cut nearly all federal money for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That's the nonprofit that in turn provides funding for NPR and PBS. Under newsroom protocol for covering our own network, no NPR news or corporate executive reviewed this story before air. Here's NPR's Scott Newman.
A White House official speaking to NPR on condition of anonymity has confirmed that a memo is being drafted that calls for scrapping most federal funds to NPR and PBS. Some conservatives in Congress have accused the networks of left-wing bias and woke programming. In recent months, Republicans have stepped up their attacks. In a social media post earlier this month, President Trump himself called NPR and PBS, quote, radical left monsters that hurt the country. At a subcommittee hearing chaired by Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, where NPR and PBS executives testified, she accused the networks of being anti-Republican.
We believe that you all can hate us on your own dime.
At the hearing, PBS CEO Paula Kerger said many smaller and medium-sized public television stations could not exist without federal funding.
When you look at a station like Cookeville, Tennessee, 50% of their budget comes from the federal government. Those are stations that I've seen that have small staffs that do extraordinary work. And those are the stations that I worry would not survive. This would be an existential moment for them.
The administration is planning to call for a rescission, a move that would block $1.1 billion already appropriated by Congress to fund the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through the end of fiscal year 2027. The memo gives Congress 45 days either to approve the cut or restore the funding. NPR gets about 1% of its funding directly from the federal government, but hundreds of member stations across the country get a larger percentage, which they use in part to pay fees to air the network's programs. Television is more expensive to produce, and PBS gets a larger share of its operating expenses from the government. NPR released a statement on Tuesday saying that eliminating funds for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting would have a devastating impact on American communities across the country that rely on public radio for trusted local and national news, culture, and emergency information. The White House memo is expected to be submitted to Congress on April 28. Scott Newman, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. We'll be right back.
If you watch the TV series The Americans, you just might wonder if your neighbor is really a Russian spy. On the next Fresh Air, Sean Walker describes the real-life program the Soviet Union developed to train agents to embed for years as citizens in foreign countries. The program fell apart with the collapse of the Soviet Union, but has been revived by Putin. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at CySimsFoundation.org. From Progressive, Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses, from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at ProgressiveCommercial.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. California leads the nation in a race to deploy battery energy storage facilities. They bank electricity from sources like solar and wind so it can be used later. Experts say they are an important part of fighting climate change, but a fire this year at a battery facility is raising questions about how the plant should be regulated. Dan Brecky from member station KQED takes us to the California coast.
But normally we have growing in here everything that we use to make salsa.
On a typical afternoon, Kim Solano would be presiding over a lunch rush. But on a recent weekday, with her restaurant closed, she's giving a tour of her kitchen greenhouse in Moss Landing on the coast 75 miles south of San Francisco.
I just did soil testing in here yesterday, so we'll see how that.
And what are you testing for?
We're testing for heavy metals.
That testing and the restaurant's closure are precautions Solano is taking after a January fire at a massive battery energy storage plant just a half mile away. Some soil testing showed elevated levels of heavy metals nearby, and Solano is one of at least 12 local residents, the plant's Texas-based owner, Vistra Energy.
I feel ashamed that I didn't ask the right questions early on when I started hearing about the idea of this plant coming into Moss Landing. I went along with the idea of we need green energy, and that seems like the best choice for us.
In a statement, Vistra points to other preliminary public agency soil, water, and air testing that has shown no immediate public health hazard. The company says it's, quote, committed to doing everything we can to do right by our community. But the fire is raising questions in other California communities about big battery storage facilities, with residents in at least four counties opposing new plants.
I think ultimately the incident has tremendous potential to derail the industry, not just within California, but across all of North America.
Nick Warner, a co-founder of the Energy Safety Response Group, which consults with plant owners and firefighting agencies, says backlash from Moss Landing could have a lasting impact.
We have answered questions in Massachusetts, New York, Ontario, and elsewhere around the continent.
Although the incident's cause is still under investigation, the view among industry experts is that the Moss Landing plant was uniquely vulnerable to a major fire. They say that's because the massive indoor facility featured thousands of closely spaced racks loaded with battery packs. That made it possible for fire to spread rapidly.
The key here is that Moss Landing is truly an anomaly.
Noah Roberts is vice president for battery storage at the American Clean Power Association. The trade group says unlike Moss Landing, virtually all battery plants are now built outdoors, and the facilities separate battery packs to reduce the chance that a fire in one unit could spread to others. Roberts says new plants should follow a voluntary national fire prevention standard tailored to battery systems. The standard is up to state or local authorities to adopt. It includes extensive requirements for facility design and testing of fire suppression and explosion control systems.
The community should require that any new facility comply with the latest version of the National Fire Protection Standard.
Although the fire at Moss Landing was the highest profile incident at a battery plant to date, it's far from the industry's only recent safety episode. California regulators have cited another 8 incidents of overheating and fires at battery plants over the last 3.5 years. A blaze at a San Diego County facility last May, for instance, burned for more than a week and prompted evacuations. The industry says the limited scope of most of these incidents show that improved fire standards and technology are making facilities safer. But
we can't take the battery industry's word for it.
Severin Borenstein does energy research at the University of California, Berkeley. He says regulators need to step up.
So I think we need independent experts who can look into the risks of the newer designs and the older designs and say, you know, these are very safe and these are not so safe, and change regulations accordingly.
California utility regulators took the first step in that direction last month, requiring plant owners for the first time to report safety incidents and to confer with local authorities on emergency action plans. For NPR News, I'm Dan Brecke in Moss Landing, California.
Record companies have a few tricks to give old albums a boost on the charts. Stephen Thompson of NPR Music spotted a few, all in this week's Billboard magazine.
One is the deluxe reissue. That's when never-before-heard songs are tacked onto existing albums. Just last week, Ariana Grande used that exact playbook to propel last year's Eternal Sunshine from number 87 all the way back to number 1. Another trick involves releasing physical editions of albums that had only been available digitally. Back in 2022, the singer-songwriter Ethel Cain released her debut album Preacher's Daughter, but without any physical editions. It's a gorgeous record, but it's a challenging one, and it failed to chart at all. And yet, when Ethel Cain released the album on vinyl this month, almost 3 years after its debut, Preacher's Daughter made its very first appearance on the Billboard charts this week, all the way up at number 10. This sort of maneuver tends to yield only short-term chart success. Last September, Travis Scott shipped all the pre-ordered vinyl copies of his decade-old mixtape, Days Before Rodeo, at the same time. That sent the album rocketing from outside the top 100 all the way to number 1. The next week, it disappeared from the chart entirely. Now, it's worth mentioning that the current number 1 album belongs to Playboi Carti. It's called Music, and so far it's only available digitally, but it has physical copies on the way. And when the album needs a boost up the charts in the coming weeks, those physical editions are sure to do the trick. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music. Give me my car so you swipe that. It wasn't you, it was me. It ain't me, it's you. I know it's hard to see. Now I would have lied and lose.
This is NPR News.
Hungary has seen a steady erosion of its democracy and civil society.
We are not yet in Turkey because the journalists will be not jailed yet. We are not in Russia because nobody was falling out from the windows yet. But day by day, we are getting closer.
I'm Elsa Chang. How some Western politicians are emulating Prime Minister Viktor Orban on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. A federal judge in Maryland is ordering the Trump administration to deliver court testimony on steps taken to return a Maryland man mistakenly sent to a maximum security prison in El Salvador. In Maryland yesterday, demonstrators called for Kilmar Abrego Garcia's return.
Justice for Kilmar!
At the White House, Trump Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt told reporters,
Abrego Garcia was a foreign terrorist. He is an MS-13 gang member. He was engaged in human trafficking. He illegally came into our country. And so deporting him back to El Salvador was always going to be the end result.
Federal Judge Paula Zinnes charges that the Trump administration has defied a clear Supreme Court order to return Abrego Garcia from the prison in El Salvador. There were several disruptions at a town hall meeting conducted by Georgia's Marjorie Taylor Greene in suburban Atlanta yesterday. She called for quiet as protests over Trump policies emerged.
This is a peaceful town hall. Now, this is a peaceful town hall, ladies and gentlemen. This should not have to happen.
Most of the crowd supported Greene, but three people were arrested. Several were escorted out, and one person was tased by police. This is NPR News. Economic activity in China surged in the first quarter of this year, beating expectations. NPR's John Ruich reports this came ahead of steep new tariffs imposed on China by President Trump.
Gross domestic product grew 5.4% in the first quarter compared to the same period last year, official data showed. A Reuters poll had growth expected at 5.1%. The expansion in the first 3 months was driven in part by strong industrial activity and exports. The government also said policies to stimulate domestic demand, including a trade-in program for old appliances and electronics, helped boost growth. The Trump administration imposed new tariffs on Chinese imports of 20% during the period. President Trump also talked up his upcoming reciprocal tariffs, which were unveiled in early April. John Ruich, NPR News, Guangzhou, China.
Attorney General Pam Bondi this morning announced a federal suit against Maine's Education Department for resisting President Trump's push to ban transgender athletes in girls' sports. The action has been several weeks in coming. In an on-camera confrontation, Maine Governor Janet Mills famously told President Trump at a White House meeting, "We'll see you in court," with Trump responding that he was looking forward to it. The administration's Departments of Education and Health and Human Services are charging that the Maine agency is violating the federal Title IX anti-discrimination law by allowing transgender girls to participate on girls' teams. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from EasyCater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend, at easycater.com. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg is taking the witness stand for the third straight day. He is testifying in a federal antitrust trial that could threaten his business empire. That's because the Federal Trade Commission is pushing for the social media company to be broken up. NPR's Bobby Allen has been in the courtroom following all this, and he's with us now in our studios in Washington, D.C. in an early morning after a long day. Thanks, Bobby.
Hey, Michelle. Good morning.
So what stood out to you in the last 2 days of Zuckerberg's testimony?
Yeah, well, he hasn't generated any controversy yet. So from Meta's perspective, Zuckerberg is doing quite well. But the FTC has a very particular mission in grilling Zuckerberg. The agency wants to show that when Meta purchased Instagram in 2012 and WhatsApp 2 years later, that it was done to neutralize competitors, so to snap up rivals seen as a threat rather than, you know, competing fairly. So to do this, the FTC has been making Zuckerberg read dozens of emails and internal messages from more than a decade ago. The FTC, you know, really wants to illuminate Zuckerberg's true motivations in buying Instagram and WhatsApp. But Zuckerberg was well trained for this moment, and he hasn't yet completely taken the bait. He has been shown old messages like one where he wrote, quote, "It is better to buy than to compete," where he's basically making the FTC's case for them. But on reflecting on them today, Zuckerberg has not admitted on the stand that Meta back then had this motivation to throw its weight around and to try to neutralize these competitors.
So what are the best case outcomes of this trial, first for the FTC and then for Meta?
Well, for the FTC, it's that a federal judge in the case, James Bossberg, finding Meta guilty of operating as an illegal social media monopoly and ordering Meta to sell off Instagram and to sell off WhatsApp. For Meta, it's Bossberg ruling that the government has not cleared the high bar for proving that Meta has acted anti-competitively, but a verdict is just really far off here. I mean, we are now only day three on what's scheduled to be a two-month trial. And some new reporting from the Wall Street Journal is worth noting, too. The paper says that Zuckerberg offered the Trump administration $450 million to settle the case before trial. Now, the FTC didn't agree to this. You know, it's possible that President Trump intervenes still, right? There was a lot of speculation that the case would settle before trial. That hasn't happened yet, but some are wondering, can it still?
You know, honestly, there are very few things that the Trump administration and the Biden administrations actually agreed on, but one of the few was reigning in Silicon Valley. Are there other antitrust cases brewing?
Yeah, so beyond this big Meta case, Trump's Justice Department will be heading to court with Google next week. The DOJ won a monopoly case against the search giant last year, and the DOJ is expected to ask a judge to break up Google. Apple, too, is facing down a pending monopoly case over a similar allegations, you know, from the DOJ over whether Apple's iPhone, you know, this walled garden that kind of traps people in Apple's system, whether that's anti-competitive. But all of these legal actions come during another trend, too. And that's Silicon Valley elite getting closer and closer to the Trump administration, really cozying up to the administration. And these companies are hoping that will mean the administration will pump the brakes on these legal fights. But if the Meta trial here is any guide, it does not look like that will be happening, at least not yet.
That is NPR's Bobby Allen. Bobby, thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump is calling for the Commerce Department to look at possible security risks from America's reliance on imported rare earth minerals. Those are 17 elements that are difficult to mine but are crucial for U.S. defense. The ask comes after China curbed exports of some of those minerals as part of its retaliation against American tariffs. China dominates the rare earth mineral market, mining about 60% of the world's supply, and the White House says America's dependence on imports exposes the country to, quote, economic coercion. So, does this give China an advantage in the trade war? I asked Gracelyn Baskerin about that. She directs the Critical Mineral Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and will note, we spoke before the president ordered the security review. So, Gracelyn, what minerals exactly are we talking about here? Rare earth minerals sounds very, very space age.
So rare earth minerals are actually a misnomer because they're not rare. They're actually found everywhere. However, they're found in very small quantities in a lot of places. There's two types of rare earths. We have light rare earths and we have heavy rare earths. And they're categorized by literally their weight. Now, these restrictions are targeted at heavy rare earths. And the difficulty is that China actually processes near 100% of these, which means not only do they mine them, they source heavy rare earths from around the world, bring them back, and they separate them, where they take the actual rare earths out of the rest of the rock in China, which makes the rest of the world highly vulnerable to any restrictions that they place.
Are they pretty much the kingpin there on rare earth minerals?
China has an absolute dominance here.
And what does the U.S. military use rare earth minerals for?
So rare earths are used in almost every form of defense technology, from warships and fighter jets to missiles, lasers, and tanks. And for you to understand just how much of them we use, in an F-35 fighter jet, we use about 900 pounds of rare earth elements.
So is the U.S. is looking at a situation where they might have to stop building things for its defense?
The U.S. does have capabilities. However, we are very late to the game. So we have actually given out over $400 million through the Defense Production Act to build those separation facilities here in the United States. But the difficulty is mining and processing is a long-term effort. I can't just build that overnight. The second thing is we do have stockpiles in the U.S. The big question mark for us is this is not a ban on rare earths. What China is doing is they are making companies apply for a license to export these materials. We don't expect this to be a transparent process. While China works out that licensing process, we will have a pause. And the hope is that our stockpiles will tide us over. But ultimately, if China wants to make these restrictions more strict, for example, by putting in a ban, that would potentially cause disruption to both military use, but also our civil use. I mean, rare earths are in your MRI scanners and your PET scanners, for example.
So are these restrictions, you think, impactful enough that China could force the U.S. to back down from tariffs?
It's a very powerful negotiating tool that they have. Absolutely. At the end of the day, the U.S. is going to have to make a decision whether it's going to continue on its tariff trajectory with China, but at the cost of the very minerals that we need for our national security, our economic competitiveness. They are in your semiconductors and your iPhone and our energy resilience, because they are in most forms of energy technology as well.
Gracelyn Baskerin is director of the Critical Minerals Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Gracelyn, thanks.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is NPR News.
Hong Kong billionaire had a plan to sell two ports in Panama to a U.S. investment firm. Now, that plan is up in the air. Next time, Here and Now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now, we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, Amy Martinez. 12 years ago in Minnesota, Gary Knox was watching his daughter's high school basketball game, and he spotted a sixth grader playing with the high schoolers who was balling out. Her jump shot, he said, was textbook. Her footwork, impeccable. Afterwards, he tweeted a picture of the girl, urging people to remember her name. But at the time, hardly anyone noticed Paige Beckers, the number one overall pick in this week's WNBA draft. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. What is a woman? That's a question Britain's highest court is weighing in on. Today, judges in London ruled that a woman is someone born biologically female. It's a decision that has big implications for transgender rights in that country. NPR's Lauren Freyer is at our bureau in London. So, Lauren, what does this ruling say?
Yeah, so today the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom ruled that the terms woman and sex refer to a biological woman and biological sex. Their ruling was unanimous. They issued an 88-page judgment that says in one part, quote, the concept of sex is binary. A person is either a man or a woman. And this is based on a case that started in Scotland several years ago, but it has big implications for trans people across the UK at a time when, you know, similar legal challenges are underway in the United States after President Trump banned transgender people again from military service there.
Yeah, so that Scottish case. Tell us about that Scottish case and how this legal process began.
So in 2018, Scotland passed a law requiring half of all board members for public organizations in Scotland to be women. And it included transgender women in that, as long as they have a gender recognition certificate. But a group of gender critical feminists challenged that. They want sex protections or quotas to apply only to people born female. Now, the Scottish courts turned them down, but the UK's highest court today has now overruled that.
So what's the reaction been to today's ruling?
So there were cheers and hugs and sort of fists pumping in the air in the court among supporters of the group that basically won this case. It's called For Women Scotland. Its co-founder, Susan Smith, spoke to reporters outside the courtroom.
Sex is real, and that women can now feel safe that services and spaces designated for women are for women.
You know, this ruling is being seen as a victory for gender-critical groups like hers. Probably the most famous gender-critical feminist in this country is somebody you may have heard of, J.K. Rowling, the Harry Potter author.
Yeah. She's been a very big voice, a very sometimes controversial voice on this issue. How has she reacted today?
Yeah, she has been. And she actually backed the group in this case financially for Women Scotland. She gave them financial support and she posted praise on social media today. She said this ruling, quote, protects the rights of women and girls across the UK. The UK government has welcomed this ruling too, saying it'll provide clarity for women. But this is really seen as a big blow to transgender rights in this country. A transgender campaigner named Heather Herbert spoke to the BBC today.
It feels just like we're following in the footsteps of Trump's America. We're attacking minorities.
And it's worth noting the judge who read out the ruling today said the UK law does still protect transgender people from discrimination. And he thinks this should not be seen as a victory for either side. But some trans groups are, you know, saying they really worry that this ruling could lead to more discrimination, possibly in the labor market against people who have been issued these gender recognition certificates. And a charity called Scottish Trans issued a call to its supporters and to transgender people across the UK today to look out for each other.
All right, that's NPR's Lauren Freyer in London. Lauren, thank you.
Thank you.
This
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Russia's deadliest strike on Ukraine this year hit the northeastern city of Sumy. Russia admitted to launching two ballistic missiles over the weekend that killed at least 35 people and injured more than 100. NPR's Joanna Kakissa spoke with a teenager who faced a dilemma during the explosive attack while inside a burning bus.
Kirilo Ilyashenko is 13 years old. He's got a buzz cut and a bandage around his head. He calls me from his hospital bed. I got shrapnel in the back of my head, he says. The doctors pulled out the two biggest pieces, but I've still got small ones in my skull. Russia attacked his hometown on Palm Sunday. He and his mom were on a bus. We were going to visit my grandmother, he says, and after that, I had wrestling practice. He was holding his gym bag. His mom was next to him, on the phone with his grandmother, talking about Sunday lunch. Then he heard a strange whistling sound. And then an explosion, he says. I was knocked down and felt broken glass cutting me. The glass shards also sliced his mother's face. The bus filled with black smoke. I did not see him, Marina says. I just shouted out his name, and he shouted back. People were also shouting for the driver to open the door. But the driver, Kirilo says, was dead. The boy wanted to look for his mom, but he also worried the bus would explode. A broken window was the only exit, so he made a choice. I decided I had to get out as quickly as possible because there was a burning smell, he says. The bus was on fire. He hurled his gym bag through the window, then jumped through himself. Outside, he saw bodies on the street. He rushed back to the bus and forced the door open. He pulled out the gasping passengers. I kept looking for my mom, Kirilo says, and when I saw her covered in blood, I looked for the nearest ambulance. Later, his eighth grade classmates thanked him for saving their relatives on that bus. They call him a hero. He goes silent, suddenly shy. Maybe I feel that way, he says. Maybe a little bit. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
Entrepreneur and former Fox News host Steve Hilton is considering a run for governor of California in 2026 as a Republican. The last time a Republican won a gubernatorial election in the Golden State was 2006, which kicked off Arnold Schwarzenegger's second term in office. It's been all Democrats since.
Hilton's new book, Califailure, Reversing the Ruin of America's Worst-Run State, argues that the state's democratic majority in government, among other factors, has led to a slew of negative outcomes for its residents. He recently joined me to talk about the book, Our Mutual Home State and Its Politics. Steve, I don't know if you have announced your run for governor, but I know it's no secret that you're at least considering it. So is this book an outline of what your platform would be?
Well, I'm certainly considering it very strongly. I love California. People will hear from my accent. I'm originally from the UK. My parents are actually Hungarian, but we moved here in 2012. I love this state. I think there's nowhere better than California, but I think everyone can see things have gone off track. And I am strongly considering running for governor. And the decision really will be based on making sure that it's possible to do that in a serious way. Part of that is to have a serious policy platform. And some of that is reflected in this new book, Califailure. But there's much more to it than that. You've got to cap financial support, sense that there's an opportunity to actually win, because that's the only basis on which I would do it.
So you're right that Califailure is what happens when Democrats get everything they want. So, Steve, what would be some of those things?
Well, it's the things that actually have been done to California by the government that we've been living under. I think the best place to start, A, is just to look at the data, look at the numbers. And if we said there's a state, one state in America that has the highest housing cost by far, the highest taxes, on and on. How has that happened? And my answer looking at that is something I think a lot of people across the political spectrum would agree with, which is one-party rule is not healthy. It breeds a sense of extremism where the only pressure is coming from one direction. That takes you in directions that are far outside the mainstream.
California has the highest housing costs in the contiguous U.S., second only to Hawaii nationwide. And we should clarify that California has the highest individual income tax rate. The state of New York has the highest overall tax burden. One of the things, though, Steve, that I always wonder about is when people look at California from the outside and they say, you know, horribly run state. It's one of the worst run states in the country. Then I think about California's gross domestic product being at $3.9 trillion, which is 14% of the national GDP. So how could a state that poorly run, is the accusation, how could it be that productive economically and even agriculturally? It's the number one agriculture state in the entire country.
And so you're right. People may say, well, we can't be doing things that badly then. But if you look at the components of that, a lot of it is driven by a small number of companies, particularly in the Bay Area, that make huge amounts of money, but actually don't employ very many people. And so that explains why you can have two seemingly contradictory things.
If you were to run, Steve, I'm not saying you are, but if you were to run, would you have a particular candidate that you would kind of salivate at, Steve, to say, let me get at you. I want to go after you one-on-one.
Well, look, I think the fundamental point is that we need some political balance in California. But when you look at the potential candidates, I do think that Kamala Harris, the former vice president, who is said to be strongly considering running. She tells us that she'll make a decision by the end of the summer. By the way, I'll make my decision much sooner than that. Kamala Harris, I think, would be a great opponent to face because, first of all, she'd bring a lot of attention to the race and the issues that California faces. And I think that's important that we can have a really serious policy discussion about how we turn things around and make California what it should be, which is the best of America.
And the thing is, Steve, that I find it interesting that you say Kamala Harris, because the thought in California is, and you live here, is that this is her job to lose.
I think the problem with Kamala Harris, if I may say, is that all of this conversation, and including the things that have been put out there by her team in briefings, are all about her. Would she be excited to be the first black woman governor of a state? It's not about her. It's not about me. It's not about the candidates. It's about California. We need to go in a completely different direction.
That's Steve Hilton. His book is Califailure, Reversing the Ruin of America's Worst Run State. Steve, thanks.
Thank you very much.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.